time. Thank you very much. Isn't that nice? I shouldn't get this award. All of you should get this award. I hope you can all hear. Without the microphone, can you hear without the microphone? Anyway, it's a real delight to be here, Gwen. Thank you very much. And Pat, thank you for doing such a great job to all of the other winners. You guys are in the trenches day in and day out, and it's enormously important that you do what you do. I don't have to remind you of that. Or remind myself of the history of Plan Boulder, one of the first people that I ever met in thinking about politics, was sort of suspicious outlier that came to Boulder County to an event up on Gold Hill, and it was Al Bartlett who gave me a lecture on doubling campaign money and how that would be a good idea. I think Ruth Wright put together one of the very first events, and I think that was an organization around EcoCycle, if I remember, Ruth, one of the first things that we did, sort of classic Boulder. And I think Plan Boulder got me to introduce the first piece of legislation, and one of the first that I introduced, which was to get highway trust money to pay for bikeways. When I tried to explain that to Tip O'Neill, it was a real reach. I understand why that was such a good idea. And I don't think that bill went anywhere for about 20 years, but it actually did happen. Also, you should know that what you've been working on in terms of a renewable portfolio standard has been a real precedent for the whole country and just enormously important. You know, plus all of the other things, the remarkable leadership here. You know, it's really such a great community. I'm reminded of Plan Boulder as Ren and I were coming tonight. You come over the hill, and boom, there's your success. You know, it's really amazing. So, to all of you, thank you very much. It's just so very, very impressive. But what I'd like to do is to spend a few minutes sort of outlining a very significant problem related to science and climate change. And I have put those remarks together in a little more formal fashion as we're right in the middle of this battle, and I wanted to frame this in as clear and precise a way that I could. And I want to start by saying that, of course, we don't want to be Panglossian in about this best of all possible worlds. All of us here are doing a good job and doing the best we can. But we have to remind ourselves of the enormous challenges that remain, even to the basic science of climate change. There is no doubt whatsoever that the Earth's oceans, atmosphere, biodiversity are being stressed to the limit. These challenging times confer on elected officials at all levels and citizens everywhere a special responsibility to stand up for what is right. Tonight, I want to underscore one responsibility in particular. We have to stand up for the dedicated scientific community, including and especially the talented atmospheric scientists right here at NOAA and NCAR, who are tonight under siege from well-entrenched financial interests who want to sow doubt about the rock-solid evidence surrounding global warming and the destruction of Earth's life support systems. The work of these interests on healthcare, climate change, and a host of other issues has fallen into a predictable pattern. When confronted with overwhelming facts about a future threat, today's vested interests unleash an army of attack dogs to scour the landscape in search of the irrelevant anomaly or misleading mud with which to sow and clog up the system. Thus, a single weather event in Washington 2 weeks ago became fodder for mindless mockery of the mountain of scientific evidence for significant climate changes around the world. A computer got hacked in the UK, revealing that even scientists send petulant emails from time to time. And a few mistakes in a 3,000-page, 130-country scientific collaboration were blown grossly out of proportion to discredit the whole enterprise, indeed, the entire scientific process. Would that baseball writers, political pollsters, or investment advisors were even close in getting it as right as the scientific community has gotten climate change. But science is under attack. We've seen it time and time again. on pesticides and chemical dumping, on smoking, on airbags, on fuel economy standards, on acid rain and ozone depletion. The attacks are withering, yet remarkably effective. Why? Because the opponents know, in tried and true techniques from the cigarette wars, that they don't have to win the argument. All they have to do is cause doubt. And that's enough to weaken the resolve of the public sufficiently for them to win the day. They also know that in today's world, the caution and caveats of most scientists are no match for a carefully orchestrated, well-bankrolled public relations offensive. Scientists work in academic cloisters and labs where the culture is one of modesty and balance. Public relations spin masters perform with cameras, microphones, large dollops of cash, and an axe to grind. Government should be helping to equalize that contest. After all, the fundamental purpose of government is to protect its citizens, to help manage the common welfare and security of the public. To put it another way, government helps us to manage risk. Understanding and protecting against risk is the reason that we have the Central Intelligence Agency, the Federal Aviation Administration, or the Food and Drug Administration. And so it is with climate change. Can I get a glass of water, please?
So you're on top.
At the behest of the world's governments, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, known as the IPCC, was formed in 1988 to provide a careful, global, peer-reviewed assessment of the scientific evidence and the risks associated with climate change. The IPCC's task has been to understand and describe how the Earth's complex and intricate climate system works, how the atmosphere, land, and oceans interact to create the climate envelope in which human civilization has been organized. The IPCC has been probably the most important and far-reaching scientific undertaking in history, involving an exhaustive review of the scientific literature by thousands of the world's top scientists who are not paid for this work. Indeed, the IPCC functions through volunteer scientists on a budget of less than $5 million per year. 5 years ago, the National Academy of Science and its counterparts in 10 other countries reaffirmed the essential findings of the IPCC, that we live in an atmospheric greenhouse, that human activities are increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases, that the climate is already showing clear signs of warming, and that the climate system will change significantly if we continue polluting the atmosphere without regard to the consequences. The uncertainties about the timing and the scale of future climate changes, also clearly delineated by the IPCC, do not diminish the risks that we face. We all live with uncertainty, and we evaluate risk all the time. Most of us wouldn't go swimming if a dangerous riptide was predicted, even though we know that it might not come. We can't predict precisely when wind shear will occur, but we rely on the Weather Service to provide warnings of dangerous conditions so that planes can avoid the risk. If a huge snowstorm is predicted, we stock up on food and bottled water. We insure our houses. We buy life insurance. We institute speed limits. We wear seatbelts. We act to minimize risk. And yet, related to climate change, we are continuing to roll the dice and impose huge risks on the economic, environmental, and security interests of future generations by changing, as we are today, the composition of the Earth's atmosphere. So what can the government do to minimize this enormous risk? It can start by standing up for the scientific method, reassuring the public as to the fundamental credibility of what the scientists are telling them through the IPCC about the prospect of costly, perhaps catastrophic, climate change. The government can make an unwavering commitment to reduce emissions and accelerate the transition to a low-carbon energy future. And it can begin to prepare for the numerous and far-reaching climate impacts that we already know are unavoidable. It would be foolish to expect the lords of yesteryear to discontinue their irresponsible and short-sighted campaign to preserve the good deal that they have. The financial stakes are enormous, and every day we delay moving toward a clean, low-carbon economy is another day for big profits, most at the expense of our children, and particularly our grandchildren. The obligation of the government is to support the science and the scientists who are warning of danger ahead, to fulfill its basic responsibility, the government's basic responsibility, to protect its citizens. We need to hear and see this support before the scientists are overwhelmed and the public debate is even more muddled by the reckless and relentless attack machines and the echo chamber of the 24-hour news cycle. This leadership is all the more important today in the wake of Copenhagen and with the climate legislation process stalled on Capitol Hill. Some question whether Copenhagen was a success. On balance, I believe that it was. First, the conference was very significant in that it raised the climate issue to a new level, with more than 120 heads of state attending, and they were therefore forced to learn themselves about the climate issue, and about the need for action. Second, the Copenhagen Accord, which would not have seen the light of day without President Obama's determined and forceful personal intervention, new global leadership coalitions emerged, particularly the BASIC group, Brazil, South Africa, India, and China, pledging for the first time the engagement of rapidly growing economies. And third, Copenhagen signaled for the first time a willingness by the world's wealthiest countries to mobilize the financial resources that are going to be needed by the poorest and most vulnerable nations to adapt to the emerging clean energy economy, as well as to adapt to the unavoidable climate changes that are already built into the system. Now, we need to build on that progress. We need to build implementation plans that contain specific and concrete steps for reducing emissions. At Copenhagen, negotiators all but completed negotiations on two critical subjects, avoided deforestation and technology cooperation. The objective for this year, leading up to the next round of negotiations in Cancun in December, should be to finalize those agreements and add at least three more on renewable energy, energy efficiency, and innovative finance. And we might, over the next year, even make progress on methane, cook stoves and black soot, and on understanding the promise of the vast new reserves of shale gas as a substitute for coal. The world probably isn't ready yet to complete a comprehensive agreement in Cancun. The overall economic, environmental, and political issues are just too big, and we can come back in Q&A if we have time to talk about that. It's a very important set of concepts. But these individual steps, or building blocks, of energy efficiency, renewables, and the like, will make immediate progress toward emissions reductions and will also build confidence that such actions are good for a healthy economy, for job creation, and for the environment. And finally, I would remind us all of the aphorism that used to be on bumper stickers everywhere. Think globally, act locally. Think global. I hope I've helped to give you some perspective on the global state of play, and we can come back and talk about that. We are deeply engaged in this, and I think I probably spend about 90% of my time on one aspect of the global negotiation domestically and internationally. But that won't do any good unless we act locally. And you were certainly the epitome of that aphorism, and I thank you. Our kids live here, and it's just great to be back. So thank you for asking me. It was a great privilege to come out to Boulder and to see so many old pals, to see so many old, you know, people who were veterans of so many political wars and other wars, and to have a chance to talk with you a little bit about the wonderful work you've done in the last 50 years and to think about that huge challenge of climate ahead of us all. So thank you very much, and I'd be delighted to get to any questions that might be appropriate for that. Thank you very much.
I'm sure there are questions. Why don't you just... Could you reflect on President Obama's recent pledge or initiative to provide an $8 billion loan guarantee to the nuclear industry, and also reflect on the Exelon Corporation based in Chicago, who apparently has some more friends in the White House?
Has
a number of friends, like David Axelrod and one or two others. We used to work with Exelon.
Well, it's a complicated, and I must say, can everybody hear the question?
No.
What I reflect on the president's commitment for $8 billion loans for loan guarantees for nuclear, and also what about the relationship between the White House, Chicago Mafia, and Exelon, which is the big the Chicago group in the White House, and their relationship to Exelon, which is the big coal burning and diverse utility in Illinois and much of the Middle West. It's a very complicated question, but let me sort of give you my perspective on what I think is going on politically. One, I think that the president really understands the climate issue and absolutely knows it very, very well, and he demonstrated that personally in Copenhagen. I mean, there is no reason to believe that this is not a 3x5 card understanding or 2 3x5 cards. I mean, he goes very deep into that and is very, very knowledgeable. Second, I think it's very clear that this commitment is not widely shared in the White House. That there, and this may go to Exelon, probably not. I think it goes more to politics in the sense that the climate issue, you know, is more than the wagon can carry at this point, that the White House has other priorities. And it was extremely difficult early on to get climate even among the top 4 or 5 issues. You'll remember when they were being identified in early months of the administration, it was healthcare, financial reform, obviously the economy, climate change, and maybe there was some education in there and a major initiative which has been fantastically carried out, focused on nuclear weaponry. So it was a very ambitious agenda. Climate sort of barely made it over the edge onto the list. The House acted in a quite remarkable fashion. Waxman-Markey came together. Henry Waxman, a very talented legislator. I sat next to him for 12 years in the House. We're in the same committee, came in at the same time, and he's just superb. He upended John Dingell, became chairman of this very powerful committee, and with Ed Markey drafted a piece of legislation that was very, very long, very complicated, and passed by one vote in the House of Representatives. It was probably the best that could be done for the time. If you looked at it very quickly and would say that was a good piece of legislation, I would have known the little that everybody knew about it, probably would have voted for it. If you dig in, there were some really major problems that sort of underlie this, and this will go somewhat to the Exelon question. The coal industry was absolutely essential for getting to 218 votes. Without pressure from the coal industry, and therefore a lot of deals cut with the coal industry, they never would have gotten a majority of the votes for this huge and impressive piece of legislation. And in fact, if the Waxman-Markey were to become law, there would be almost no reduction in terms of coal burning over the next 30 years. Coal has got all kinds of give back, and it's a pretty level commitment to coal. That's pretty remarkable, I think. And the other thing that is, I think, very concerning about the legislation is that part of the deal for the coal industry and the votes that they brought to the table was the preemption of EPA's ability to regulate. Under the Clean Air Act, the EPA has the most remarkable set of authorities of any piece of legislation in the government. It's probably the single most important piece of domestic legislation, can reach to just about anything. And in this legislation, the ability of EPA to regulate related to climate change was preempted and removed from the law. That was in the draft of the bill. So at first blush, you know, they did the best they possibly could, given where they were, with these, I think, two great gaping holes. Now you get to the third problem that they had was the cap-and-trade mechanism, which was cap-and-trade. John Heinz, my good friend John Heinz, and I were the people that invented cap-and-trade. We brought it for the first time. It became part of what all of us worked on the Clean Air Act years and years ago. But that was added to it was an auction provision, which became a major potential revenue share, and that killed the legislation completely for any Republican who wasn't, there was no Republican who was going to vote for something that increased revenue. So it was a real problem for once we got to the Senate with all of these kinds of issues. And times have changed. They've changed a lot. And, you know, the Copenhagen, which had lots and lots of promise a year and a half ago, had much too high expectations and was not very well managed in lots and lots of different ways. And very important meeting. Good accomplishments came out of it, but lots of political expectations were dashed by that. It was okay substantively, not good politically. I mean, you do two things in a meeting like that. The substance and then the constituency building. The substance was pretty good. The constituency building was terrible. So that, you know, how do you balance overall what happened there? Copenhagen occurred, then the Supreme Court decision on campaign finance, which is going to provide a huge amount of problems, it seems to me, to almost any progressive move in the United States. It's going to make it really difficult unless Senator Schumer is successful in what he's trying to do. So that was a second big problem. And the third was, of course, the loss of 60 votes with the Massachusetts election. So what is this then, to go back to the beginning of the question, to the president's view? The president remains as committed as he was, but he's also looking at a very different political landscape. And unfortunately, I don't think that he has been given the kind of vision or strategy for how to handle these new pieces that he needed. So he came out with a strong statement about carbon capture and sequestration as a major nod to the coal industry. You know, they'd already gotten a lot of nods in this. They're getting the whole body, you know. They're kind of astonished. You know, one of the few of them. Coal fire power plant in Boulder. I've never understood. And the other thing that he did was the major promise for loan guarantees for nuclear, which is probably a promise that sounds good if you say it fast enough. But the reality is there probably isn't a utility in the country that's going to build a nuclear power plant because it's so incredibly expensive. It takes such a long period of time. Is filled with so many risks and has so many other problems. There might be some in South Carolina, there might be some in a few other places, but it won't be a major contribution. It's a political move. So he made two political moves. Unfortunately, that was not part of a bigger strategy to really define how the move to a low-carbon economy really was going to be a green jobs initiative. You know, there's been a lot of arm-waving about green jobs, but not very much specific attention to what that actually means. Organized labor has gotten involved in it, sort of waiting to help and get to, and to dive in. It's not been well developed. There was no reference at all, and has been none, to the enormous reserves of natural gas that have been discovered in the last few years, which are real game changers in terms of thinking about climate change. And there's not been as much insistence on the relationship of natural gas and renewables, which is a natural partner. They've been set off against each other in legislative proposals, and they should be natural allies in this. So there's a still a big strategy piece that's missing overall in energy and energy legislation. And that's probably more than any of you wanted to know about it. But it really is intriguing because it touches everything. You know, as we were talking, Marin and I were talking about it the other night. She said, you know, what you do is like opera. And I said, I can't sing. I'm tone deaf. She said, no, that's not what I mean. This is really true. This was last one. She said, what it is you have this extraordinary plot. And you have remarkable scenery that's out there. And you have great music. And you have amazing actors. You have the whole load. You know, and that's what energy and climate legislation is. It's all, everything is there. It's absolutely fascinating on the environmental front, on the economic front, on the political front. All of these themes are engaged in this, and that's what makes it so absolutely fascinating, and what makes it also so very disappointing, you know, to those of us who've been, you know, working on this for such a long period of time, that this hasn't been front and center, and the administration has yet to figure out how a strategy can relate to, you know, what's going on in 2010, very different from early 2009. So that sort of takes you back, I hope, to the question.
I have a question that flows from that. If the cap and trade legislation fails and the EPA's ability to enforce its rules is therefore not enforced, what can the EPA reasonably do to bring down some of
that? It's a really good question, and it's the right question. The EPA has a tremendous amount of authority. We're going to have a major meeting in 10 days, I think, just on with all of the major interest groups focusing around this to make them understand how much authority EPA has. EPA can, for example, set up a cap-and-trade program. Can't set up a cap-and-trade program with an auction in it, but we've never before had a cap-and-trade program with an auction. You know, the cap-and-trade program on the Clean Air Act related to acid rain was a straight cap-and-trade. There was no auction. It was a cap-and-trade, and then the cap was slowly but surely squeezed down, and it was incredibly effective. You know, and then the Republicans were very critical of the current cap-and-trade program and because of the auction, so that's a real problem. But EPA can set that up. EPA can set up a whole regulatory regime. It can go sector by sector across the power sector, across the automobile sector, as the Supreme Court decision said that it could, pick up on the California rules and move ahead. It can set standards related to home efficiency related across the board, and set standards related to what public utility commissions ought to do. Lisa Jackson, who is the administrator of the EPA, from New Jersey, and you know, she was the environmental administrator in New Jersey, and you got to know that's got to be really tough politics. You know, she's a tough cookie, and she's really strong, really committed, and needs, like a lot of this, a lot of support, and I hope that she's getting it, the kind of support across the administration that she needs. She's got a huge amount of authority. Final point, the president has to say very clearly to those who want to preempt the Clean Air Act that he's going to veto any legislation that does that. That's where the line is, you know, and that's what a president has to do. You just draw the line and say you can deal to the right of the line, but not to the left of the line, or you can deal one side and not the other, because we're not going anywhere if you preempt EPA, period. And just make that very clear, and that'll shut down a huge amount of noise and a lot of other things, as, in fact, he's done in the last week on health care, which for the first time he's really stepped into it and said, this is what we're going to do, we're going to move ahead, and that kind of clarity. You know, the Congress stands up and pays attention. You know, if you give the Congress its head, it will kind of wiggle off and try to slide off all the tough areas and, you know, get reelected and do all the things members of Congress do. But you have to, you know, they will line up and shape up if, in fact, the president, you know, gives a very clear sense of what they ought to do. So it's a huge authority.
On cap and trade, you know, a lot of water has gone under the bridge. Really huge transformations have been made in the financial sector in the last 20 years since you and John Hines got together with that cap and trade idea, and particularly the trading aspect of our investment banks has really taken over from their traditional function of putting capital together with innovation, Goldman Sachs being the prime example, particularly under Lloyd Blankfein and Gary Cohn. We've seen recently the New York Times and one of its front-page article was talking about how Gary Cohn had invented trading instruments for Greece that A, allowed them to hide their real indebtedness from the EU, and B, then created a trading mechanism in London to allow traders to bet on the default of Greece. And it was said by one of the people on Wall Street that it's like basically taking out insurance on your neighbor's house and then lighting, you know, a fire to your neighbor's house so that you could profit from the insurance. So what I'm saying is that George Soros and other hedge fund managers equally have said that they're very much against a cap-and-trade mechanism to try to set the carbon price because of what has essentially been the result of the deregulation of our market. So now Maria Cantwell and Susan Collins are proposing a cap-and-dividend bill, which even The Economist magazine has really come out in favor of, because many economists feel that simply a tax of sorts is the most efficient way to do this. So my question is, after all the water under the bridge that has happened since you and John Hines got together, would you be in favor of a cap and dividend bill like Maria Cantwell has proposed?
You know, nobody really understands what it is. There are two pieces of legislation related to sort of capping emissions. You know, the first was the one that was in Waxman-Markey, and they also did an economy-wide cap. They capped every source of carbon in the economy. Essentially, in my view, kind of sticking a sharp stick into every single constituency you can imagine, and the hornets were swarming out, and not a smart thing to do. You know, you take them kind of one at a time, and don't make everybody angry, at least in the first month. They did, but there was a cap and trade like what we had done before, but they added a different kind of a revenue measure. Maria Cantwell has what's called cap and dividend. There's a cap, and the is also effectively a kind of an auction, because to get the benefits of a cap, you have to pay for certain carbon permits, and the money for that goes back to taxpayers. You know, it's, I think that it probably won't go anywhere, because you get all involved as well. There are a couple of people who are for it, but it doesn't have any momentum now. I think what will happen is that Senator Kerry, who with Joe Lieberman and the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, a Republican, are trying to draft, are really working very hard to try to put together a strategy that will hold together. I suspect that they will have some kind of a cap mechanism on utilities only, on coal-fired power plants only. And that's what they ought to do, and that could be a very effective mechanism, and leave it as a pure cap program. It doesn't have to do anything to do with Wall Street. The guy who made the most money on sulfur dioxide lived around the corner from me, and in Washington was a sort of very entrepreneurial lawyer who saw an opportunity in this and put together the first trading mechanism for trading sulfur. And it didn't, it was just done between the utilities themselves. And you have a relatively small group of people. So it's a, you know, it's an interesting part of the economics of this. Again, this gets down into more of the weeds than all of you were counting on for tonight, but it's also really interesting. So let me stop at that. With that, there are no other driving questions, which there aren't, thank goodness. Again, it's a real privilege to be here, and I thank you very much. I'm going to be back tomorrow, late tomorrow afternoon, back in Washington. We're trying to mount this counterattack to protect and defend the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. A lot of really interesting parties involved in that, and a lot of people on the other side. And so that's going to be sort of the skirmish. You'll probably be reading about that. You might have already. Sort of is the current battle that's going on in the war over climate change. But if we can't win this one and can't sustain and maintain the integrity of the science and the respect for the science, then everything else is going to slide away. You know, what governments do and the reason they do it and the rationale and so on will all start to disappear. So this is the most important set of steps. And it's a privilege to be able to work on that as well. So thank you all very much. Have a good evening.